But did you want to be a judge all your, at least, college and law life? Where did this idea of a judge planted in your
brain? As a junior in law school, I had already had 1 year of law school before I went to the Marine Corps. Then I served on a court-martial or two when I was in the Marine Corps. When I came back to law school my junior year, I formed a very firm impression that if I ever get an opportunity to be a federal judge, induced a lot by the fact that there's lifetime security to it, so an appointment for life. If you could keep your nose clean, you can't be removed, or your salary can't be diminished by making unpopular decisions. You can be independent, in other words. And I determined at that time that that's what I would like to be, never thinking that there'd likely be an opportunity for me to ever do that. But that was when I was a junior in law school.
Was it the security of the job, or was it the actual work of being a judge that attracted you?
It's a little bit of both, but mostly it's the work. I really enjoy resolving disputes or helping people resolve disputes in whatever role I can be. And I think that's borne out by the fact that I do an enormous number of settlement conferences for the other judges since I've taken senior status. That's to help settle. I don't have any authority in the case other than to get the parties together and visit with them and reason with them, give them the benefit of my experience to help them resolve disputes. And that's the part of this job that has always appealed to me. And, of course, having grown up poor, I've been somewhat security conscious, and this provides certainly not a way to make the most money, but it provides reasonably good security. All that added up to my wanting to do this very much.
We should mention that when you were a special lecturer at OU, one of your students was a gentleman by the name of Andy Coates.
Still is a friend of mine, despite exchanging insults and accolades down through the years.
Tell us about him a minute.
Well, Andy is, as everybody knows, an outstanding person. I first met him when I was judging moot court competition down there at OU. He immediately stands out. He was selected as the outstanding senior in his graduating class at OU, and I recommended him strongly to the Crow Dunleavy firm, to Bill Paul, who was my best friend in law school. They hired him, and of course he had a successful career there, ran for office unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate, but he became district attorney and then mayor, successful mayor, and then has for the last 14 years been the dean of the OU Law School, and they named the building after him down there, justifiably so.
You applied for a grant from the Ford Foundation, and you went to Harvard.
Went to Harvard in 1962. I got a Ford Foundation fellowship in law teaching to the Harvard Law School and spent a year there and completed the paper and lectureship for an LLM.
You chose personal injury litigation as a topic of your graduate
program.
That's
what I was really very much interested in. I taught damages down at OU, and then I'd practiced some personal injury work at ADA, so that was the main subject. But I took some courses in estate planning and in creditors' rights and so forth as well. I was able to do that.
You sat in on lectures by Henry Kissinger.
Well, I did. We could audit lectures. I didn't know anything about Henry Kissinger when I went up there, but I kept hearing this name that he was an outstanding guy. We went over and audited a couple of his classes on national security and so forth.
Were you impressed by him?
I was not terribly impressed because I had some difficulties with his language, but of course he almost immediately became a national figure in the government. He was in Washington all of the years that I was with the Civil Aeronautics Board.
Your Harvard degree was very helpful to you as you came back here?
I think so. I don't know how much it helps you. It helped to do a lot for my confidence, you know. There's a quote, if you have a degree from Harvard Law School, there is a presumption that at least you're not a damn fool. But Andy Coates goes around telling him, he said, down in Antlers, Oklahoma, where Lee grew up, it doesn't even change the burden of proof. He did that recently. I went with him to a speech out here 3 days ago, and he's still using that line.
Meanwhile, the firm of Deaton, Gassaway, and West is flourishing.
Doing well.
You represent
by small-town standards.
And you represented an old cowboy by the name of Don Wilkins.
Don Wilkins was from Bucky, Louisiana. He's a cowboy and a horse trader and judged a lot of quarter horse shows. But he was injured in Oklahoma in an automobile accident so that his ankle was pretty badly broken. We represented him. We called another cowboy, Don Wilcoxon, who used to be an old trick and fancy rider. He testified at the trial that Don was an outstanding horse trainer and that because of these injuries, he had lost his ability to spur or train horses and that it had cost him enormous income and all that sort of thing. I was very doubtful about using Don, but it turned out he was a very persuasive witness. The jury gave us $35,000 damages for a broken ankle, which was not only the largest in Pontotoc County, but that was a huge amount of money that long ago. So the word got out that we could do a personal injury case. And we were doing fairly well when this vacancy for the court came up.
That would be the Ada District Judge John McKeel.
John Boyce McKeel died of cancer.
That was in 1965. So tell us why that was significant.
John Boyce McKeel had been a long time elected district judge there and was a good judge. He called me when I was at Harvard, as a matter of fact, and we had talked about the fact that I'd like to be on the bench and that I certainly never did intend to run against him. But he called me to tell me that if you want to try to get this job, you better get on back down here because I've been diagnosed with cancer and prognosis is not good, so you better come on back, which I did. Instead of taking some teaching engagements that I could have gotten, and rejoined Austin and Jim practicing law down there. When he died, Henry Bellman was the governor, although I did not know Governor Bellman at all, and he was in the Republican Party. I applied along with Calvert Cannon, who was a Democrat, and Bob Macy, who was a Democrat, but Bob, when he heard about John Boyce becoming ill, he transferred to the Republican Party, thinking, of course, that that might assist him with a Republican governor. After we went through interviews and everything, I was still pretty pessimistic that there would be a Democrat appointed down there because some of the senator's staff had told me very candidly that they were encouraging him to appoint nothing but Republicans, you know. But at any rate, he, for whatever reason, selected me and appointed me across party lines to be the district judge in the 22nd Judicial District.
Governor Bellman did that.
Governor Bellman did that.
And at that time showed that he was his own judge and jury and made his own decisions and probably rarely listened to a whole lot of people and pressure.
It was amazing to me because when I went up to interview, one of the staff members told me, Mason was his name. He used to teach out here at Central State University. He said, Lee, you have a lot of good friends and supporters, but I'm not one of them. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, because we're trying to urge the governor to appoint Republicans. Sure enough, that conversation never came up in Henry Bellman's office. So he made the judgment independent of at least some members of his staff to go ahead and cross party lines. It was only later that he and I became friends. After he had appointed me, I didn't think he was going to do it, to tell you the truth.
So then, giving him credit and you credit, he decided you were the most qualified. If you'd been a Republican, he would have named you, but he named you, and you happened to be a Democrat.
Despite being a Democrat, as he's frequently and publicly said, he deserves the credit.
I believe he said that you were the least offensive Democrat from Little Dixie.
He said that many times, as a matter of fact.
So for the next 8 years, you enjoyed your work.
Very much. It was an enjoyable, thoroughly enjoyable position.
Tell us about Uncle Elmer.
Uncle Elmer West was not an uncle of mine, but they quickly nicknamed him Uncle Elmer because he was not at all fond of me. I don't know, some of my rulings or something had aggravated him because he'd walk up and down the streets. He told Francis Mayhew, who was a lawyer friend of mine, he said, you know, they ought to give that Lee West a sanitary hearing. and appoint him a guardian. I asked Francis, I said, Francis, did you defend me? And he said, well, sort of. I told him, I said, he might pass a sanity hearing, but there ain't no way in the world he'll ever pass a sanitary. Elmer was a character, and I'll tell one more anecdote about Elmer. He had a lot of enemies around town. One of them was Melvin Choco, kind of a smallish guy. And he walked up behind Melvin one day at Melvin's place of business, and he hit Melvin with a roundhouse hook in his right ear. Well, when Melvin turned around, he just happened to have a tire tool in his hand, and he cracked old Elmer right between the horns with that and knocked him out. No charges were brought. One other occasion, Esco Myers, who was no admirer of Elmer's, they got into a confrontation, and Esco pulled a pistol. It went off. It didn't hit Elmer, but Elmer fainted from fear. He's later complaining to Gordon Melson, who was the district attorney at the time. He said, why didn't you file charges against him? And he said, Elmer, I had more people complaining and want me to file against Esco for missing you. Elmer was a character. That's the best you can say for him.